SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, hour two, on this Thursday. Beautiful again here in upstate New York. And I wish I didn't like hearing that Jenny said they're fighting a little iffy forecast there at Kentucky Downs. And, of course, what was it, last year? Or was it the year before? Last year, I think, right? They lost the day, which is really too bad, of course. And the makeup portion. And we have to get a visit in with Corey, too, with C.J. Johnson and or Corey. If you go back over the last, 15 years of the show, we kind of tracked everything that went on with Corey Johnson and what they were trying to do at Kentucky Downs, and then the success that came with the historic racing and how they broke down that barrier to get the enhanced the machinery and get the opportunity. They really changed the landscape for Kentucky. I mean, it's not what had been campaigned for originally, and even Churchill with the new parlor that is being built and is right just about ready. Right, they're opening soon. The over at the Spectrum, over by the training track, by the training center. So a lot of positives that have come out of this and. Ellis that was teetering a little bit, and of course the Red Mile, they had the opportunity to do the same thing, and the expectation that the Jack Casino people are going to refresh Turfway, which is a very viable long term important for the year round circuit. In Kentucky for the Thoroughbred program. So, really an amazing story. And the race, just from a pure gambling standpoint, it's fascinating. They're all puzzles, and the field size and the nuances of the course, the only European style racing in this country on the flat. And of course, the chasers, they go on undulating courses on a regular basis, including Far Hills, where we're not far yet, but about 8 weeks, a little less, to get to Far Hills. Not before a stop at Belmont, and Dave, not going to be able to visit with Dave Grenig, unfortunately. Dave tied up today and is traveling tomorrow. So, no Dave, but Belmont, of course, opens tomorrow. We talked about it with Andy. The Christie Cat, nice field of 10. Three-year-old fillies going 6 on the inner turf tomorrow. Nice card tomorrow to get things going at Belmont. And since we're kind of touching on the tracks that are getting started, of course, Los Al I mentioned already once, but Laurel reopens on Friday. As well for the fall season and toward the winter. And they got a nice opening day card tomorrow as well. Lots of turf action, and including a feature that brings together a big field, actually, and first level allowance, fillies and mares going a mile and a 16th. So after the nice visit to Timonium, and we're waiting for Tony, after the visit to Timonium, It's one of my favorite photographs every summer end. The horse is coming around the turn, the Timonium, with the big Ferris wheel right behind it, right behind the corner of the track in the parking lot there when they set up the carnival side of things. It was pretty funny. I'll mention no Tony, huh? All right, he might be. Maybe he's getting wrapped up at Philly today. Unless he's coming right this minute, and Casey's going to try one more time. I didn't hear anything from him, Kay, in terms of not being able to visit. The opportunity. I don't want to launch into something if Tony turns right up as I start. So, well, since we're talking Pennsylvania, I can tell you, and Baffert did tip his hand a little bit to us on Monday or Tuesday, Tuesday, and McKenzie yesterday with Baffert and his team getting ready to wrap up their summer at Del Mar. McKenzie, with what looks like a very nice 7/8 work for the Pennsylvania Derby, and although Baffert was a little noncommittal? Did you sense that? Maybe a little bit when it came up. I guess he was waiting for that work, and now he said yesterday he looked great, went strong, and still on schedule for Parks for the Pennsylvania Derby, and that's a lot firmer than we heard from him on Tuesday. Tuesday, he really was iffy. So, he must have come away with plenty of confidence off of that work yesterday. In fact, there's an interesting portion of that workout. The fact that he worked the 2-year-old filly, Derlew, you know, who was a very impressive winner at the beginning of August, that he would work a 2-year-old filly with McKenzie speaks pretty highly of her, right? That's an interesting matchup, and that's a conversation we enjoy having with trainers about decision making. And it's funny, sometimes you'll see when it comes to the clocker notes, the clocker report, you'll see the same names over and over again. You'll see horses that have been paired up and have been working with each other all the time, but then you'll also see horses that have a different workmate regularly. So there's some philosophy to be fleshed out in that end, from that side of things. It's kind of I haven't had that discussion in a while. I've asked that question, but if for those that have been utilizing clocking reports all summer, it is going to be a little. I'm going to miss, I got to say, it's a big part. California, one of the reasons I gravitate to California a lot of times is the regular availability, National Turf, Andy Harrington, and during the summer here, having the clocker report for Saratoga with Mike Welch and Dave Grenig and Donnie Harris, their reports. There were so many horses that, I took a optimistic or pessimistic view, thanks to the report. And now we're going to start at Belmont, and it's not, you're not going to have that tool. That's the one thing I I kind of wish if continuity into the fall wouldn't hurt. That'd be nice. Because to me, especially with the maidens, and I mentioned a couple of times here on the second half of the Saratoga season how often the maiden races were productive. I mean, even into closing weekend here, I brought it up with Seth yesterday, if you just were listening to the end of yesterday's show. Seth and I had Harold Lerner, and when he noted Harvey Wallbanger, it was going to start, and as soon as I saw him in the PPs, I was anxious to see what was said. And to get a horse like that into your, in with the obvious horses, that's how you leverage those maiden races. In fact, I will even go so far, since we've got time, Casey's having trouble finding Tony. I'll even read you what was noted about that race. And, everybody knew that Complexity and the Pletcher baby, King for a Day, that they were the two big name entities, right? So how do you leverage an even money or a 6-5 and an 8-5 into anything good? And having heard Harvey Wallbanger from Harold Lerner himself, the name was in the back of my head. So here's the comment. Broke slowly between Awesome Adversary and recent debut winner A Bit of Mischief. Showed off a change of pace once in stride and put in a serious rally to prove best around the turn. Talent evident. Overall fitness, the major question, Mark. A week before, the note is, Colt is showing he has a little talent. Best in company last two drills, today by a length over Cigar City, last week while in a gallop outside of Liberty's Pursuit. So there were two positive indices that Harvey Wallbanger was okay. So we put him in as your value horse and tie him in Keyed Complexity and King for a Day. The horse that I did not care for was Binary. I know that the Violette runner had kind of a middle of the road comment, and so I was not as interested in him. And I added the other Chad Brown firster, that Azrael, who had some nice consistent works and had actually been paired in one of his works with Complexity. So everybody was cooing over Complexity and King for a Day, and here's a horse that had kept company. Dovey Lovey, as we brought up with Gary Contessa the other day, had been paired with Sipican Harbor. So these firsters, when you have the opportunity to get a couple of hints, you have to, and it's a feel. It's not anything more than kind of a gut reaction. And I've said before, when it comes to national turf, there are certain phraseology that I see that consistently from Andy Harrington that may stand the raise. That's for me, that's always a buzzword. May stand the raise, meaning a horse that maybe broke the maiden and now is facing winners, or a horse that was claimed for 25 and now is going to compete for 40. That, to me, that's always a very positive indication that a horse might be good enough. So, and I'm a big believer anyway. A lot of times I will side with a horse in that scenario, a horse that just broke its maiden, now facing winners for the first time, and faces a bunch of horses that have maybe been trying the level repeatedly, 0-3. Sometimes you'll see a lot more than that. They had horses that were, that have tried to clear a condition 6-8 times. You want to have them try it a 9th or 10th time, or do you want a horse that may have just broken through and may be in the process of taking a next step? That's where the clock reports help a lot. And of course, you also, you should be going to xbtv.com as well. And particularly, with horses on the move right now from venue A to venue B. Check through the on-demand workout videos because it's copious. Well, unfortunately, it doesn't look like Tony might have a problem. All right, so no, wait, Casey said that just when I'm ready to pack it in. Casey says, wait. Don't give up just yet. Just yet. He might be having Tony calling back after. There he is. Sure enough, like a bad penny, he turns up.
See, you gave up too soon. But you know what? I went to the track, and I had some errands to run, and I left my phone in the car like a dummy. And I rushed out here to get it, and it said two missed calls. I said, man, I'm really slipping. How you doing today?
I'm good. We had a variety of things to bounce off of you, and of course, it's also a big night in and around the Delaware Valley, Philadelphia tonight. The Eagles resume, and the season starts, and all of us that are Eagle fans, we get to. For the first time in my lifetime, actually, Tony, I can defending champion. I was only a year old when the last time they were defending champions, 1961.
61. I was 10 years old. I had defeat by 9 years, but I was a Eagles fan then. But it means more now. I guess you get to a certain age and you say, man, are we never going to do it again? And then we do it. And then, of course, everybody has a lot of trepidation because of the preseason hasn't looked stellar. But I just mark that up as, they're just going through the motions. They know what they have. And, of course, we'll all be glued to the TV tonight to see exactly what transpires. And it's exciting, yeah. Defending champions, can you believe it? And you think about what he must have done throughout the past, off season, and now he has to go out there. And the way people are thinking, boy, it almost like he's got to start proving himself again. And he's already done it. He's already proved himself. What else can he do? You won a Super Bowl, but you're going out there tonight, and it's everybody's looking at him like with some skepticism because of preseason, which should mean not a lot.
No, exactly. Well, you talk about getting to a certain age, and Tony, that was exactly the topic I was going to throw by you, and have been rooting for and watching Victor Espinoza fight his way back from a very serious spill.
Yeah,
and he's close. He's got 30 more days now of rehab, but the neck brace came off, and Brett Beach says the end of the therapy and the return is now at least in sight, but I use the term quitting on your own terms, and you and I have discussed it not in a while, but you never, as a rider, it seems, you never want to be forced out by an injury. You want to come back, and when you decide it's time to quit is when you quit.
Right, and I've had that luxury, so I know what that feels like. I also had the spill that the doctor, when he's looking at me, and I'm sitting there with my Kylie, my significant other, and he says, "Listen, Tone," he says, "this is career ending. This is career ending." No, I didn't have any paralysis, but he says, "It was fractured my 5, 6, 7, 8, 9." He says, "You obliterated your your T5, 6, 7, 8, 9, you obliterated your T7. He says, you don't even have a T7. He says, we're going to probably think about either putting rods and fusing and all that mess, or we're going to see how erect we can get you with a brace and see how, when the swelling leaves, how what it looks like. And like I said, I joke about it now because Kylie was sitting there and tears were coming down her face. And there was no tears when he was telling me this because you, a jockey understands the reality and the dangers of the profession. You never focus on them till you absolutely have to. And when somebody says this is probably career ending and you still can move your arms and legs, you're not believing it's career ending. And Kylie, she's crying, and I'm thinking, well, she sees them paychecks flying out the window. And that's the joke I made of it, you know. She sees them paychecks flying out the window. And I'm saying, you know what? We'll see if it's career-ending. I'm not being obnoxious in any way, being arrogant towards the doctor. But I says, we'll see if it's career-ending to myself in my own mind. And it was like 5 to 7 months later, I'm not only getting on horses, I'm back riding races, you know. So I can really sympathize when you hear about these. There's been a girl, her last name is Black, that was injured recently, and she obliterated her T8, and she's paralyzed at this point because the injury is new, and it's from the neck down. I can't think of her full name, and that's maybe I shouldn't even mention it unless I could think of her entire name. But with Espinosa, and you see him sitting there, and he's going through therapy and rehab. You know, with his career, the stellar career that it's been, some people are saying, well, what else can you do? You know, pack it in. Don't take a shot of this injury getting worse and you falling again and not being able to walk. And I guarantee you, in my own mind, the way I think, and I'm sure many jockeys think this way, he's probably not thinking about packing it in until, as you just said, until he says, I'm going to pack it in on my own terms when I decide it's over, not when an injury decides it's over. And that's the way professional jockeys that really love what they're doing think. They don't think when they get hurt, boy, is this going to happen again. And I'm repeating myself. I know I've told you this stuff many times over the air. They're not thinking, oh, is this going to happen again? They're thinking, how long is this going to take to get over? And that's the way jockeys think. They don't think like, is it going to happen again? It's, how long is it going to take? How much business is this going to cost me? How much is it going to take away from my life rehabbing, healing and rehabbing that I really, really want to get back in the saddle? That's the way real jockeys think. And, you know, I might have been a third-rate jockey at Parks, but I was a real jockey in my head.
Well, we thought the names that came up in this conversation, in Ramon Dominguez,
right.
Victor's own brother, Jose Espinosa, who had a real hard time believing that he couldn't come back, and then had to, you know, had to accept it. And I wonder how that you know, is weighing on Victor as well.
Right.
And 'cause, you know, Jose was already sidelined during the period where Victor was on his way to a Triple Crown, and with California Chrome. Ramon, as an example, and Rich Migliori, another example.
Great riders, all great riders. Yeah,
Jenny Reese brought up Cisco Torres, who tried to come back from the injury and then pretty quickly said, this is not smart, and accepted, you know, that it was over. But at least he came back from the injury and rode at least rode in the afternoon and made the decision himself from that standpoint. But it's hard, Tony, not to think about Jose Flores as the opposite end.
While you're talking, I'm thinking about him.
Yeah.
Because I saw him the Saturday before the accident, and I had to take some insurance paper to Victor Molina that he'd given me some information, because we handle all the insurance for the jockeys at the time. And he says, you know what? And he says, when I get to 5,000, I think I'm going to think about packing it in. And he had had some serious injuries to his radial vertebrae, the neck injuries. And I said, don't be like me, drag it out. But most of the time, riders, when they finally decide, and they're riding, and they decide to pack it in, it's because there's a thought that goes through their mind, and it's not always fear. It's, I can't perform at the level I performed prior to the injury. And that's what they think, and that's what makes them pack it in. Because you don't want to go out there and embarrass yourself. You don't want to go out there and not be able to compete at the high level of competition that you competed at all those years. That's what makes it pack it in. And usually that only comes, well, it comes two ways, with age and you're losing a step, you know, you're a step slower, or injuries make you a step slower. And Jose, I know he was really doing well, you know, he was winning races every day and he was still excited to be a jockey. But I think in the back of his mind, you know, he said, I'm not going to be like, when I hit 5,000, that's it, Tony. I think that's going to be it. And that was the Saturday before the accident. And that was what he said to me. And I never realized, I mean, I'm thinking back to it. I'm right in front of the kitchen. He just seen me walking into the office and called me over. He was still sitting in his truck. And can you take these into Victor Molina? I said, oh, yeah, I'm going in there now. I never thought that when we were talking, they were going to be his last words to me. And it's a heartbreak when I think of that. So I said, quit today. But you couldn't have taken him and put a gun to his head and said, quit today, and he would have had any, you know, desire to quit. He was still loving winning races, and he was still winning, and winning is what keeps you in this business. And long losing streaks because you feel you're slowed down or you're a step behind and you can't keep up, that's what makes you quit, you know. And like I say, age and injury usually causes that to happen. You know, you lose a step. You know, that I always think of that because I get on this horse in the morning, and her name's Impassalante, and I think that means a step in front. And I asked the groom, how do you say a step behind? And we were kidding about that. I said, because this viejo hombre, me, maybe getting a step slower. He says, oh, you know step slower. You know step slower. I said, okay, then I'm un pasalante. I said, maybe I should ride her. That should be my last horse that I ride.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. Speaking of which, update on Collegeville girl?
Well, she's doing really good, hasn't gone to the track yet, and you know who's going to be in on her first day back to the track. But I watched the vet inspect the wound, you know, took the bandages off, redressed it, and it looks so superficial, you know. It probably was a deep gash, you know, on the outside of her left front leg. It was stitched up. But that doesn't look like it's complicated anything to the tendon or the suspensory, you know. All looks, you know, well intact, not a lot of inflammation other than if you have a little cut someplace, you get a little inflammation. But nothing was torn, you know, no tendon sheath or, you know, and it's so close to everything that's so important, suspensor tendons and tendons. And all it is superficial. When she goes to the track, that'll give me probably, as soon as that thing closes up 100%, that'll give me 100% confidence to say this wasn't career-ending. And the horses, they go through the same thing. You know, there are career-ending injuries. And there are horses that are such great athletes, you know, they overcome what would normally be thought of as career-ending because they're highly competitors, highly physical, athletic competitors. They don't want to quit. And you know what? Jockeys can relate to that.
No doubt. Another topic I was saving for you on the corner of the desk here. And I'm going to pull it out, and that is the handful of suspensions. Saratoga, there was all kinds of steward activity, Tony, and the Saratoga residuals include Errat Ortiz and Luis Saez, Jose Lascano, Manny Franco, Javier Castellano, Davey Cohen, Dylan Davis, either all getting fined or being given days coming out of the variety of situations. And we talked about some last week. And then there was, and I'm going to ask you if you've ever been involved in them, a double DQ the other day that was just, to me, mind-numbing. It was one thing to take the first horse down that initiated the whole issue. Then they take a second horse down that had no business being taken down. Have you ever been involved in a double DQ?
I can't think of the name of the horse, but in 34,000 mounts, I was involved in a double DQ. I finished third and was the proud recipient of getting put up from third to first. Because we were coming down the stretch. I was in the middle, just off of the fence with a horse just to the front of me and one to the outside of me. And as we came to the wire, well, several jumps before the wire, not just underneath the wire. Like the 70-yard pole, they came together, and guess who had to disappear from the middle of them? And the inquiry's up, and it wasn't any grandstanding because I was lucky to finish third. The inside horse came out, the outside horse came in. I got stood on my head and still maintained the third position at the wire. There was an inquiry put up, because it was so obvious. And of course, I claimed foul. I said both of them got me, Judge. And you know what? I was put up from third to win. But that's a very unusual occurrence. I didn't see the ones that you're speaking of, and I should have. I should have gotten them from you. But it's a very unusual occurrence, you know. And, like I said, 34,000 mounts, 34,000 times around there. I only was put up once in a double DQ.
Well, and frankly, the way you describe it is it's very similar to what transpired here the other day. I'll send you the link, and you're gonna laugh because I think it's very close to what you just described. And I'll let you adjudicate it. But talk about the meting out days, and what's your preferred, as a participant, what's your preferred scenario to take the penalty or appeal, depending on, you know, how you feel about it. A lot of times they'll cut them in half if you accept the penalty. And then from a better standpoint, Tony, watching and knowing how people react and their frustration, is it better that the horse most deserving stay up in the case of an inquiry, let's say, and then the stewards, if they want to penalize a guy, penalize them after the fact, but don't injure the bettors who were on the right horse. And this is a thing we talk about and hear very often. It's like, you know what? There wasn't enough of an infraction. If you take the horse down, you're penalizing the bettors. If a guy created a situation, you know, that was a little dangerous, okay, fine him and or give him days, but don't take horses down that were clearly best.
Yeah, don't take horses down that were clearly best, and the best thing the stewards can say, well, it's at our discretion. We thought maybe the horse would have finished a little closer. No, you don't take him down. You know, pull that rider up. Call him in. You know, if he's persistent in his carelessness or his over-aggressive style of riding, pull him up, give him days, fine him. Days really do make a point when it comes to a rider, because he is done. He's losing business. You know, you want to give him 3 days, 5 days, 7 days, you know, do that. But don't penalize the bettor. The betting public, you know, they see him cross the wire. It's not clear and decisive that this horse was obvious, that it was obvious that he absolutely took the win away from the other horse. Don't penalize the bettor. Penalize the rider. Don't penalize the bettor. Now, when it came to days, on only a few times did I appeal days. Once, when the state steward, which I talked about this, told me, you know, that number shouldn't have come down, appeal it if you feel that. So I appealed the days. We had the number put back up. Very unusual. Another time, I was at Monmouth Park in the summertime, of course, and I got days that were well-deserved for something that happened earlier that week. One that weekend, they had a stake schedule of, I think it was Friday, Saturday, or Saturday and Sunday, and I was on I think one of the horses was Boyce. I forget the other two I was on. So I got the days, and I'm going to wind up not being able to ride these two or three horses that are in stakes. So they said, well, if you appeal these days, yeah, you can hold, and then drop the appeal. You know, instead of giving you five, we're going to give you seven because we're going to think, we're going to, and it's not going to be a double jeopardy. We're just going to say we reevaluated the case and didn't rule enough days the first evaluation. When we reviewed it at the appeal, we thought it was more deserving of more days because that's how dangerous it was. And I said, well, I'm going to appeal the days because I don't think the days of coming down the stretch, whatever it was the week before, you know, and not dangerous situation. We just, I think I hit right hand of came in and horse and me made contact. It was brushing and a little bouncing. I don't think the days for something that wasn't a dangerous situation was meant to cost me two or three stake mounts that the horses will be very tough. And then, and if you calculate the money, I think it came to about $12,000. I said, I don't think the days were designed to cost me $12,000, but I'm going to appeal them. And that was, my uncle was a steward up there. He says, well, he says, we hate to see that kind of action. He says, but you do what you want to do, but you'll probably get a couple more added to it. So I appealed the days. I rode that weekend and all three horses won, and it came to like $12,000. And then, of course, after all three horses won, the next day I dropped the appeal. And I took the next week and started my days. I dropped the appeal, started my days. He says, I understand the story. He said, I understand where you were coming from. You know, $12,000 severe penalty for brushing and making contact down the stretch. We understand that. But we're going to give you two more days on top of that because we think that was the standard way of doing it up there. You have the appeal. The commission maybe will be harsher in their decision of how many days to get. So we're going to give you a couple more days. I said, no problem. I said, you know, like I said, $12,000, three nice horses. I think Boyce was one of them. I can't think of the other two. Three nice horses to ride like that. It was well worth the next 7 days that I'm going to be suspended. But I always figure, you know, and then I got more than two times days in my riding career. I got days on several occasions and, you know, for careless riding, for being overly aggressive and crossing that line. It's one thing you're aggressive and you're competitive and you're, you know, you're riding people tight. And then it's another thing where you cross the line. When you cross the line, you pay the penalty. I always took the days when I paid the penalty. And pay the penalty. I always took the days, you know. And most of the time, they're well-deserved. But also, you know, getting back on what you said, yeah, don't penalize the public. If it's something that the stewards can deal better with that rider one-on-one in the jock's room, and it isn't clear and decisive that the horse was bothered and was going to win, that was bothered, penalize the jock, not the public.
Absolutely. Tony, you said one thing before we go. You said one thing that I think people would love to get some insight. The left-handed and right-handed stick, and in addition, you know, where you use the stick and how often you're prepared for how the horse may react, because a certain percentage obviously are horses that you haven't gotten on. I mean, there's some that you do get on and some you've ridden many times and that you've used the stick. What is your position when you go to hit a horse that you don't know? And sometimes a trainer will address it pre-race and say, you know, be careful with him, on the turns, or, you know, be careful, just show him the stick. What is your, and what is the typical rider preparedness and attitude when you go to hit a horse, especially a young horse who, you know, we see this most often. A horse will react surprisingly to stick on the offside, and how much in the morning, how much preparedness has there been so that a horse is familiar that he's going to get some urging with the stick?
With the best trainers and the most proficient exercise personnel in the morning, usually young horses become accustomed to the stick in their right hand, and maybe by the time they get to the races, young horses very rarely have seen a stick come at them from the left side. And you know, this is just something that occurs. And it's not negligence on the part of the exercise personnel or the trainer. It's just it's more comfortable to get them out there in the morning. You take young horses, you put a stick in your right hand. You show it to them maybe once in a while on the left side, but it's not a daily occurrence where the right hand is a daily occurrence. When a jock hits a horse, whatever side he hits them on, you know, you want to make sure that the reins are taut to a certain extent, you know, the bits up in his mouth. Both sides, you're ready to grab if the horse reacts in a negative way to the stick. Young horses, you know, you can actually tap them on the shoulder, and as you flick the stick forward, outward, a horse's eye peripherally can see that stick. So he'll give you a little indication of how he's going to react. Now, because the stick's in your hand and it's uncocked, you know, it's straight up and down on your right hand. When, let's say you go to snap him on the shoulder, and he gets a little feel of the stick, and he also sees a little bit that stick because he's got the vision to see that stick if it comes out off of his right shoulder, and he reacts to that, well, then you better be aware when you cock that stick that the horse is not going to duck in if it's in your right hand. And you leave the gate, everybody leaves the gate with the whip in the right hand. And you have to become very ambidextrous when it comes to carrying a stick. A jock has to be able to switch it from right to left, and you have to switch your stick back from left to right just as efficiently and effectively. But whenever you use a stick, so many times I almost like flick it forward and let the horse, young horse, see that stick. And it'll give me an indication when I really go to cock that stick what he's going to do. That's young horses. Older horses, you know, used to be one of the things I would interpret in my own mind. A trainer would say, geez, you know, when you come down the stretch, which I always felt like if I hit a horse right-handed and I'm trying to get response from him, if I don't hit him left-handed down the stretch, it would be like negating something that's very important. If you hit them right-handed and they're running straight, you know, they're not lugging in, or they're, you know, they're not getting out, you know, then if you're fighting to get past a horse that's in front of you, or horses that are in front of you, you always want to try to hit them left-handed at least once or twice, because the surprise factor comes into play. You know, they're so used to it right-handed, the left-handed urging, that surprise factor might just get the adrenaline flowing and have them accelerate, you know, a couple strides. But that's where jocks become very aware of what they're doing on a horse's back, and they watch a horse's ears. A horse's ears will show you what he's going to do. You go to cock your stick and that horse pins his ears, he probably isn't going to do a lot when you reach back and crack him. But you're going to reach back and crack him once to see if he gives you some acceleration. If he doesn't give you acceleration, then don't sit there and just beat on him. That's when the whip becomes abuse. You know, the whip can be a factor that is used to encourage forward momentum of a horse. Or you never want to use it to steer a horse, but let's say a horse is lugging in. When a horse gets the lugging in, you know, that's where a jock has to become very efficient with his left hand, where he brings the stick over in his left hand, waves it at him, and if he so chooses, strikes him once with it. And that sometimes will stop them from laying in, or at least it'll help you steer him. But you steer a horse with his reins. You don't steer him with the stick. And any jock that goes out there and steers a horse, you know, and uses his stick as his main focus of steering that horse is not doing the right thing. Your reins are to steer the horse. You know, you might change a horse's mind a little bit with the stick, but used properly, a stick will help you get more momentum from that horse used properly. Used improperly, it's the device of abuse. So that's where, yeah, when I was out at, I think it was Canterbury, I was talking to the commission and the stewards, and they said, we're putting in a stick rule, and we're getting opposition to it. I said, well, what's the rule? He says, you hit a horse three times, bang, 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 and then you have to go back, put both hands on the reins, push on him before you can hit him again. I said, there's no problem with that. I mean, really, I rode a lot of races. I would hit a horse, boom, boom, and then, slap him twice, push on him, push on him, push on him, wave it at him, wouldn't even hit him, wave it at him, you know, push on him, then reach back and crack him once or twice. He says, well, we're getting a lot of opposition. I said, well, that's the problem. You know, people have not been taught when it comes to riding races and horses how to properly use a stick. And you know what? The people that are monitoring the race, you don't even need a rule if they are very aware of how jockeys are using the whip and pull them up even without a rule. You see a kid just sitting down, you know, wailing on a horse 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times. That's BS. That's not effective race riding. That's the way, improper way of using a stick. You hit a horse a couple times, you wave it at him, you know, you push on him, you see if there's a response. Then you switch over, you wave it at him left-handed, you hit him a couple times, see if there's a positive response, and he's getting by the horse that you're trying to get by. If there's not, waving it at him is sometimes as effective, if not more effective, than reaching back and cracking him. But that's an art in riding races, you know. You have to teach someone the proper use of that particular piece of equipment. It's a piece of equipment, you know. It's a tool. It's not meant for abuse.
When you go to hit, too, the shift of weight, right? They've got to be able. They've got to anticipate and know that something is happening because the way you're balanced is changing.
Yeah, you know, your right shoulder. You go to reach and hit a horse in the hind end. You know, your right shoulder's coming up. But when you're doing it properly, when you're using the whip properly, and you have a good purchase on a horse, you're not really changing a lot of weight distribution. Your right arm comes up, you come down, you know, behind your boot or under the belly at times. Sometimes you wave it at them. If your body should stay very much in a very still, very firm purchase, you know. Where you get movement of a jockey, it comes mainly on their legs, you know. Sure, your upper body moves a little bit, but when you want to move a horse to change leads, you don't always do that with the reins. You do it with swaying your weight. You know, a horse goes in a turn, he's on his right lead, you pull the right rein out a little bit, and then you knock him in with your knees, not with pulling his head into the left rein. You knock him in like riding a bicycle. You know, you've ridden bicycles. You don't need to steer with the handlebars totally. You steer with your weight. Well, riding a horse, when you're using your weight properly and you have the proper purchase on a horse's back, you know, you're firm. You're not flopping around. When you have the proper purchase on a horse's back, you're not flopping around, and you can use your weight to the left, to the right, to move that horse. And hopefully, when you go to hit a horse, you're not throwing your whole body. You're hitting from the shoulder and the arm, and you're coming down on the horse. You're not raising your upper body up, you know, raising your chest up off of your knees and trying to come down and kill him and cut him in half. You're trying to do it from the shoulder and arm, and the only thing that's moving is the shoulder and arm, not your upper body, if you do it right and you have a good purchase on a horse.
Well, because your torso, by keeping the torso in harmony, you know, with the horse and without shifting, and because that we've talked about this, not in a long time, but that's will take away from, you're already got a horse. If you're going to go to hit them, they're already probably tiring. You're asking for a response, and if you suddenly, if your balance is all that's doing is fighting against him and adding to, you know, the challenge for him as or her as a horse. I mean, it makes it even harder for them.
Absolutely, you're causing him to go from side to side instead of forward. You know?
Right. Exactly.
And sideward motion is not forward, and it takes away from forward motion. You know, and on top of that, if you do it and you're really abrupt in the way you do it, you'll cause the horse to pop his leads. You know, Now, where you don't want him to. You know, he's coming down the stretch. He's been on his left lead all the way around the turn up to the head of the stretch, and you finally got him to change to his right lead. You don't want to throw your weight around where you pop him back over to his left lead because you're hitting him left-handed or right-handed. You want him to stay on that fresh lead.
Right.
And I always talk about leads. You know, it's like a suitcase, a guy carrying a heavy suitcase with his right arm, and then he gets so tired of his right arm, he switches it over to his left arm. He gets tired on carrying that suitcase with his left arm. The muscles are tired, so he switches it back to his right arm, right? Well, that's how horses use their leads, and that's basically the fundamentals in having a horse use his leads properly. You know, he uses a lead that is his freshest in the latter stages of the race. That's my thing. The freshest lead he has, the one he's been on the least amount of time, his freshest lead, hopefully it's his right lead because you paid attention around the turns and everything else with his left lead. You know, maybe he went down the backside on his left lead, which is fine because he's running straight. Goes into the turn on his left lead. And he goes all the way around the turn on his left lead. And then he comes up the stretch, pop him over to his right lead. That's his fresh lead. But what if this horse has been running a distance of ground? He went around the first turn on his right lead. He went down the backside on his right lead, you know, so he went all the way up the stretch around the first turn on his right lead, down the backside on his right lead, and then he hit the 3/8 pole and he changes to his left lead. Okay, well, what's his freshest lead when he hits the quarter pole? His left lead. It's not imperative to always make a horse change to his right lead if they've used them improperly in the early stages of the race. If you really are tuned in, you want to make the horse use his leads properly. But his left lead, he was only on it for a quarter mile. Let's let him stay on it. But I love when the commentators say, oh, he came down the stretch on his left lead. But what, for 3/4 of a mile, what lead was he on, you know, when he came down the stretch for the last 3/8 of a mile or a quarter mile? What lead was he on for the 5/8 or the 6.5? They never say that. So sometimes your freshest lead's your best lead. And it might be the wrong lead. They call it the wrong lead. It's freshest lead. But that's a jockey point of view. And you know what, Steve? The point of view I used riding, you know, probably maybe there's some jock saying, geez, well, you know, this guy don't know nothing. But that's the point of view I used when I was riding. And many a time I was on the lead, and they came to me figuring I'm empty, and my horse was on his freshest lead through the lane. That's the only reason they didn't get past him. And a lot of times they swamp me, and I look like a bum.
Well, you ride, when you ride 30,000 plus times, you're going to get a little bit of both. So, Tony, this is great. It looked for a little bit like we weren't going to get to you, and then we end up with a tremendous segment. I appreciate it.
I'm sorry I left the phone in the car. I ran into
that's all right.
Here and left. But thanks for giving me the time. Keep up the good work, and I'll listen to the rest of the show.
I appreciate it, Tony. Tony Black, everybody, and just a couple of weeks away from coming down for Pennsylvania Derby and Cotillion Day, 22nd, and we'll be down there at Parks, get a chance to see Tony, and looking forward to that, too. Let's take a time out. We actually are coming up toward the top of hour three. Steve Haskins is going to join us, and Rich Eng yet. So another hour on this Thursday. Day two of Kentucky Downs, day one of Los Al. They'll come back Saturday. In fact, they probably drew. I didn't think to look for Saturday. The Beverly Lewis and the Johnston, too. So the first of the stakes schedule at Los Alamitos on the Thoroughbred side. I told you about the maiden race. There's a good maiden race today and a good one tomorrow. Today, the 6th, a mile for the 2-year-old boys, and they'll go short tomorrow, the 5.5. Some nice pedigrees on display. We'll talk some 2-year-olds with Steve Haskin, actually. We'll talk about the outcomes of the hopeful and the futurity, as well as the debutante and the spinaway, among other things. And I'll see why. I'm curious. The Yoshida versus Catholic boy discussion, too, from the Woodward. Back after this, hour three at the races.
latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest. We know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $100 are on them. That's right. Sign up at ExpressBet.com using promo code XBRadio, bet $100, and they'll deposit $100 back into your account the very next day. Hey, plus you could get an extra $25 if you use Express Fund Direct Deposit. You see what I mean? House money for betting the races. It's that easy. Check it out at ExpressBet.com to learn more. And don't forget to sign up for promo code XBRadio. You're gonna love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee. Must be 18 years or older and 21 years old in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void or prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.
Pennsylvania's breeding program is truly the most lucrative in North America. Now, we'll pay a 50% breeder award for PA-sired, PA-bred maidens who run first, second, or third, with 25% for non-PA-sired, PA-breds. Last year, the number of mares bred rose by 15% in Pennsylvania. And unlike some other states, our Racehorse Development Fund can only be used to support Pennsylvania breeding and racing. This is Brian Sanfratello. Please visit us at PABred.com.
Hi, this is retired race caller Tom Durkin. So, after this year's Derby, I stopped by Top Round Roast Beef on Shelbyville Road in St. Matthews. I got two sandwiches, one for back at the hotel and another for the trip back home to New York. The first one was so good, I had the other one right there. Certified Angus beef, roasted 5 hours, each one made to order. You can taste the difference. Top Round Roast Beef, Shelbyville Road, St. Matthews. Tell them Tom Durkin sent you. Oh, by the way, try the frozen custard too.
Hi, John Parada here, inviting you to join me in the Dublin Racing Club, along with friends like Steve Bick and Tom Durkin. If you have an interest in Ireland and horse racing, it's the best way to be involved with both. So log on now to DublinRacingClub.com and come join us at one of Ireland's 26 racetracks.
The Dublin Racing Club is designed to introduce racing fans to the ownership experience by participating in the sport in Ireland. For more information on the Dublin Racing Club, log on to DublinRacingClub.com.